from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the GoodAtheist.net podcast. In our second week of Atheist Appreciation Month, my unofficial way of trying to interview people who I think are important to the scene, up-and-comers, unappreciated individuals that make up the silent majority of the group, really, where you have a few people that you think are really dictating things, but it's the people behind the scenes. And today I have a very special guest. His name is Peter Boghossian. If that name sounds familiar, it might be because you've listened to a couple of his lectures that I've put up on the site, or perhaps you've heard some of his podcast. Essentially, he's sort of like really emerging in the scene, if you want, because he's had a couple great talks. One of them on the Easter Bunny. And ways that to try to demonstrate how critical thinking applies to really just about everything. He teaches philosophy at the Portland State University, and he basically teaches about critical thinking, epistemology, reasoning, so all that good stuff. So please welcome my guest, Peter Boghossian. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. Now, one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you was I remember I was reading an article about some of the stuff that you do outside of just teaching, and one of them in particular was the way that you were using critical thinking, the Socratic method, apparently, when working with inmates. And I'm like, there was nothing else to this article except for that. I'm like, well, I'm fucking curious. What is that all about? How does it work? And is it effective?
That's a great question. And thank you for asking me about something else other than faith or God or religion. It's really nice to be asked about something in my primary area. So basically, the Socratic method is a way of asking people questions that help them come to conclusions for themselves. And so I ask people structured questions in a way to help them use a process to enable them to arrive at true conclusions. And the prisons are, it's a fascinating environment. It's a wonderful environment to do that. I have the curriculum. It's available free and online for anyone who wants it. And basically I run through basic, questions in the history of philosophy, main figures in the history of philosophy, but at a very, very rudimentary level, and it's been designed to help people's reasoning processes.
So you give them, you don't just give them a copy of Sophie's World and send them on their way?
No, there's no reading. I can't assume that anybody knows how to read.
Oh, I see. So it's really that basic.
Yeah, it's that basic, and the idea is that the content can be conveyed through the pedagogy. In other words, you can get people to achieve a learning objective solely by your way of teaching or solely by the method of teaching them. So the communicative interaction that you have with people, it teaches itself, is a way to teach people how to do something.
Now, I don't want to be the obvious, turd in the pool here, but isn't it possible that when you're trying to teach someone to reason, that all you're doing is just, potentially also creating an individual that now has the ability to rationalize irrational choices? Like, how is it that you can, if given a short course on critical thinking, is it not possible that a person can still warp that and have still a fractured philosophy that is consistent?
Yeah, you're right. It's possible. It's absolutely possible.
How do you make sure that it doesn't happen? What are some of the steps to make sure, okay, well, the things that you're reasoning, because you're working with inmates here, and obviously there has to be some degree of reconstruction about their role in society or their opinions about it. So where do you start with someone who's broken the law?
Honesty, and I know that people don't like one-word answers to things. Honesty, nothing else is required.
Like, is it a litmus test in order for you to determine if a person is actually being part of the, like, doing the process, or why honesty?
Well, no, honesty on my part, not on their part. Nothing else is required. It took me a long time to figure that out. Honesty and then epistemic humility, or humility about what you know. The most important thing, hands down, without any question about it. And there is a mountain of educational literature on this. It's called pro-social modeling. There's a mountain of correctional literature on this. I mean, truly, it's not just subjective, it's conclusive. When I say men, the facility is an all-male facility. The men in these classes, I mean, these people have been beaten down by life. There's no question about it that they've had structural barriers, have had an unbelievable number of problems in their lives. And if you can model the behavior that you want them to emulate, that sets them on their course. And so I'm incredibly honest when anyone asks me a question. I'm incredibly blunt and incredibly direct. And I think that directly answers your question of how they can't come to rationalize things. Because I am the corrective mechanism. I am someone that they can ask, and I don't have all the answers. I mean, far from having all the answers. But they'll know when they ask me a question that they'll always get a direct and honest answer, and that can keep some, not so much that it keeps their ideas in check, but it gives them a little reality check as they work through these processes themselves.
Well, I was listening to one of the podcasts. I think it was on Philosophy News. I'm not sure. You can probably correct me there, but there was a discussion about the fact that in the soft sciences, we'll call them, there is a tendency for people to no longer say that's wrong, where it's just like that's interesting or so on and so forth. And sort of like stemming from that idea, does it come from really having to work with the pragmatic approach to philosophy of learning? No, you do have to put your foot down.
That's a great question. In fact, I just finished an article, and I submitted it just the other day, about why is it that in the soft sciences the responses that students give are treated differently than in the hard sciences. You know, if I say to you, hey, look, I have this example I use in the paper. Hey, look, I have the influenza virus. I have a theory about how the influenza virus works, right? And this is my theory. And I say, blah, 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 here's how it works. And the students say, no, you know, that's not my theory. And you say, well, what's your theory? And you say, well, I have theory Y. Oh, well, what's your evidence for theory Y? I have faith in my theory. In the hard sciences, that would simply not be taken seriously. But in the soft sciences in the classroom, if someone says they have faith in their idea or what have you, that's the white flag of surrender. Everyone says, well, okay, they have faith. I guess that's the end of that conversation. No, well, I mean, we treat those responses differently in the soft sciences than we do in the hard sciences. And I'm saying that's wrong. That has to end.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I guess you had mentioned is that you're trying to deal with the way that people come up with ideas, the axioms that they rely on to tell them about the world and how they've reached those conclusions. And
some of those are false.
Right, demonstrably false.
Right, I mean,
like you can just show that they're false.
Absolutely.
But you're still, I think that one of the things that shocked you, and you mentioned this before, was that you had you wrote an article dealing with this, you know, very basic idea that, no, if you have false ideas, then they should be called out for. You need to establish a framework that's logical and reasonable. And apparently there was a lot of controversy that surrounded that one article.
Absolutely astonishing that the thesis of the article was, should use facts when you can. I mean, I can't even saying this to myself. I don't know if I should laugh or cry about how preposterous the response to this has been. That you should confront someone's beliefs with facts, with the best available evidence, and then you ask them to formulate their beliefs on the best basis of the best available evidence. But for whatever reason, if that falls in faith domain, then you ought not to do that. So, for example, if someone says, I have faith that the Earth is X thousands of years old, or what have you, or whatever the faith proposition that one claims to believe, all of a sudden confronting that with facts is considered to be discourteous, disrespectful, impolite, violates diversity requirements, and the list goes on.
And most of all, arrogant.
Arrogance, yes. Who are you to claim? I mean, and then they pull out the Thomas Kuhn, you know, oh, so science has been wrong so many times. How do we know you're not wrong?
Don't forget the people that are like, oh, well, science isn't properly defined, which is still a very true statement, but it doesn't mean that we don't have a very intuitive understanding of what science means and what science isn't.
Right, and I think that we can get to the heart of this whole matter by talking about belief revision. I think we can cut away through all this discussion and say, are you willing to revise your beliefs? Are you genuinely willing to change your beliefs? In science, you can look at the history of science, and we do this in the philosophy of science, we study this, is that people confuse an epistemology with a metaphysic. You know, they confuse. I was just talking about metaphysical naturalism the other day. People have these confusions in their head about things, and I think it's really important to tease these things out, but start with the fundamental question, are you willing to revise your beliefs?
There's something strange about the words metaphysical and naturalism together that seems to be like, is that not an oxymoron?
Yeah. It's interesting. People throw these different terms together. Discovery Institute is great for throwing these terms that don't go together.
Metaphysical naturalism. What? The meta-study of things that are objectively real. What?
I was just reading some fascinating stuff about that. But hey, let me just finish this thought before it flees from my head. So I think if you think about these communicative interactions, you can save yourself a ton of time by just saying to someone right from the get-go, are you willing to change your mind? And if someone says no, I personally don't believe that. I just think it's verbal behavior. But first of all, I have two options. It's binary, right? Someone says yes or someone says no. It's possible that someone could say maybe, but that, I think, falls into the yes category. So if someone says, no, I'm not willing to change my mind, then you have to ask them, well, why not? You know, what is it about this? And then you can get them, I think it's not too difficult to help them see that having these fixed ideas or fixed beliefs is a hindrance if they want to find things that are true.
I suppose, though, you kind of have to be talking to individuals who have a desire to pursue the truth, and I don't really think that's... I mean, most people might say they do, but it's kind of like that effect where if you're polling people about certain things, the polls and the voting will be really different because what people say and what they do is really different. Like, and they may not even realize it.
Right.
And I think in this instance, it would be really difficult for you to be able to determine the difference. Like, if I talked to you and said... say you were very religious people and told you, are you willing to change your mind? I think that a lot of people who are still no's would say yes. And then even if you were to ask them the conditions that would be required for that yes, you'll find that those conditions are impossible to meet. Like, you have to disprove that God is real, which is an impossible thing to meet. And meanwhile, in their own minds, they've met the criteria of an open mind. They're like, well, I've already given you the way to get me out of this,
even though
it's basically an impossibility. So I think that there's a large part of the problem maybe even in a person's own delusion about their open-mindedness.
Right. Excellent choice of words on your part. I think that's right. I think, again, you know, we talked before this about simple ways or simple questions that you can ask to get to the heart of the matter. Look, here's the heart of the matter. Do you believe it because it's true, or do you believe it because it makes you feel good? If they tell you that they believe it because they're true, even if they're not sincere, it doesn't make any difference. Because then they're playing, then they're using language and reason, and then they're in the domain of language and reason and rationality.
So they step into your field, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the way they quote unquote win is, you know, either they grunt or they dance around or they don't say anything. And back to the prison thing, in prison, if someone doesn't say anything, the treatment is less effective. I mean, they can learn by hearing and by watching the Socratic method. But if you ask someone a direct question, you know, if you're having a discussion about whatever it is you're having, God or faith or what have you, you say, well, is it more important? Why do you believe? Do you believe this because you think it's true, or do you believe it because it makes you feel good? And if they tell you that they believe it because it's true, even if they don't actually believe it because it's true, then they've entered into the domain of rationality.
I would advise people that if something feels like it's very rare that something will be true and feel good. I'm like, those are the rarities, and if that's one of them, you should probably be suspicious of it.
Yeah, should you feel good about all your moral beliefs, it's not clear to me. I mean, it's also not clear to me that if you don't have any beliefs that you're uncomfortable with, you're probably not thinking critically.
Well, I guess you're not giving yourself a real psycho analysis. Alan Freud even doing it himself, although apparently he could not see his own obsession with cigars, hilariously enough.
Yeah.
We're all blind about something.
Yeah, I think we are, but that gets back to the other point about, I said, honesty, nothing more is required. I mean, we all have to be honest with ourselves.
I think we fear that.
I don't know. I think some people do, but I also think that there are ways to elicit that. That's the attitudinal dimension of this whole thing. I think that through the Socratic method and through certain ways of asking ourselves and others questions, we're more likely to arrive at conclusions that are reliable.
I guess at the end of the day, you really have to teach someone how to how to be honest enough to reveal the flaws in their own thinking. Because you can't, it seems to me as though pointing those out are fairly ineffective most of the time. That you just, you kind of have to lead the horse to water, but he's going to have to drink it. And to some degree, I guess that's how I see your application of the Socratic method, as a method of just getting these horses to drink.
I was thinking about that as you were speaking. It's clear to me that you've thought about this a lot. It doesn't do any good for me to point out a fallacy or a mistaken reason. It's not productive. It doesn't move the conversation forward. I mean, I do with my students, but that's a different context. Ideally, people need to do this to themselves. They need to impose this systematized way of thinking and clarifying their thoughts. And you can summarize it very quickly by, you know, giving a counterexample. Someone starts with a question. Well, you know, Socrates says, what is justice? And justice is harming your enemies and helping your friends. And he says, well, what if your friends are actually bad people, but your enemies are actually good people? Then you'd be harming good people. So things like that, like literal ways to think about things. Again, you don't need a book. You don't need to assume anybody can read. All you need to do is to model this behavior, model this way of using reason to help people realize that they have beliefs that aren't true.
Is there part of this method that requires that an individual have, I don't want to say higher ideals, but a kind, you know, sort of like maybe a certain degree of idealizing certain concepts? Like you mentioned justice right now. And I would say, well, if I was part of the justice system the way that most criminals were, I would have a very realistic, probably even unfortunately realistic view of how justice actually plays out, and therefore kind of feel as though my own definition of justice, I could either just reattempt to have this idealized version that the rest of us who were not part of the correctional fucking system might have, compared to someone who's actually gone through it.
I think that plays some part. I mean, this won't work on people who are criminally insane. So if someone is classified as criminally insane, all bets are off. But it will work on virtually everyone else. Here's a question that I've been thinking about for over a decade, and I've come to a conclusion. I don't think, I will say that it's probably in the minority of the minority. Plato asks whether or not people knowingly do bad things. I don't think they do. I don't think they do, and I've talked to inmates in depth about this. It's really an incredibly profound question when you start to think about it.
Do you recognize your own wrong, kind of a thing?
Well, I mean, let me give you an example. I know someone who's in the hospital right now, and she's in her 70s, and she has, boy, she had a stroke, a heart attack, she had kidney failure, just a whole host of things. And I know that this is going to touch a nerve with some people when I say this, and I don't, I mean, my goal isn't to set people off in a certain direction, but my goal is to just help people conceptualize this problem and use this as an instance of that. So she was always overweight her whole life, and the vast majority, if not all of her complications right now, are a direct result of type 2 diabetes, which is entirely preventable. So when you ask the question, do people knowingly do, and it doesn't even have to be bad things in terms of a moral action or a moral idea. I mean, I wonder if you were to say, well, look, you know, was it worth those years of eating dessert? Because now her family is suffering, right? I mean, now everybody in her life, it's not just about her. We live in networks and communities of people. And it's just so touching to see all these people come to the hospital and see her and who love her. And I mean, I also think it's the same with these guys in prison. I don't really think that they, to borrow a word from Highland, that they grokked what it is that they were doing. And it's a really intense thing to hurt somebody else, you know? I mean, we live in these communities. We're family, you know, we have kids and brothers and sisters, and I don't think that the people who do this at the time they did it really got it, like really got what that meant to hurt somebody. Because you're not just hurting them. You're hurting all these other people, and you're hurting yourself when you do it.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, if I take a look at, say, weight is a, I think this is probably another good, I'm not going to say metaphor because it's not really a metaphor, but, you know, if you look at the way that people gain weight, you know, I know that, you know, imagine someone who's trying to lose the weight that they've already accumulated. One of the big problems they have is that you not only have to sort of try to get your body to burn all this fat, but you also have to fight the forces that make that body more efficient at not burning it. In a sense, you're kind of combating against the demons that you've already, you know, sort of taken in already absorbed, and it becomes just much more difficult. But, you know, as speaking as someone who's all recently gained a shitload of weight, well, not that much because I'm still skinny, but, you know, and watching it happen, I realized that part of the reason that it was easy for me to do it is because, you know, my willpower was sapped by all these other things where I felt that any just, you know, like for me, I'm going to have that soda, I'm going to have that chip. It's because there's all these other aspects of my life which I feel out of control, which I feel that it requires willpower and discipline in order to do, that I have none left when it comes for all the things that I should be doing in order to lead a good, healthy life. And I suppose that, you know, to some degree, I don't want to put too much blame again on society, but only to put sort of like find the solution, the fact that we are creatures of limited willpower. And I think that even that applies to the individuals who act in a criminal fashion. Like, lack of willpower is combined with the ability to rationalize your way into anything. These are terrible things.
Yeah, the Greeks called it akrasia, a weakness of will. And there's some interesting literature by this guy by the name of Bandura who talks about moral disengagement. Like, we know what to do, but we just morally disengage ourselves, so we don't do it. But that gets back to two things. The first thing is, you know, how do we instill the qualities of reason and rationality in people? I strongly believe that it's through the Socratic method. And how do we, even further than that, these are attitudinal dispositions. Like, how do we get people to have a willingness to revise their beliefs? I mean, the more I've thought about this question for years, and I really do think that people don't knowingly do bad things. They act in such a way, and I was actually just thinking about this again today, so it's funny it comes up in the conversation. I was walking down the road and I was seeing all these people smoke, and I don't like cigarette smoke, and I had to literally walk to the other side of the street. I think for some reason they love to hang out at the engineering building at PSU. And I was thinking about that in this context of, maybe it is that I don't know something. You know, I've talked to people who smoke and they say they think that it's worth it. And that's fine if that's really a rational deliberation or a rational calculus that one has entered into. But all of these things, like, let's say that every single thing you said was correct about, you know, there are problems with will, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that you just said can be marshaled for reasons why we should value reason and rationality more and not less.
My problem goes back to what we were saying before, where, like, we're not rational animals, we're rationalizing animals. And my fear is that when a person has the ability to come up with ways of just establishing a rational viewpoint, it doesn't necessarily mean that viewpoint will be moral.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that's it sort of speaks more to a perhaps what's more of an intuitive element of humanity, what's still part of us that needs to be, you know, it's mal understood, but it's well, you know, recognized by people. Like, why are we inherently good? And there's a bunch of explanations. I lean more on the biological portion of it, and also kind of successful mathematical strategies that are eerily familiar to golden rules and things like that. But at the same time, I'm like, I feel like in any society, they can produce evil that seems at least entirely to them rational. So I don't know if that in rationality, it's kind of like Robert S. McNamara said, rationality will not save us. And I think that what he meant by that is the fact that you can have systems of thought which are consistent and still fundamentally wrong, like on levels that maybe I wouldn't be able to debate and explain to you, because I know them intuitively as being wrong, but I don't know any way of de-rationalizing what you've already come up with.
I mean, Habermas calls that dark modernism. And I guess my first question would be that how does one know that those were principles of reason in the first place? I mean, were they really principles that someone sat down and reasoned through, or, to use your word, and people make this confusion all the time, were they rationalized? I mean, there philosophers have done some fascinating work with this. John Rawls has done some great stuff. I personally don't know. I mean, I've been thinking about this question a lot. I don't know what to think. Ultimately, I have to say, I think I have just asked this at a lecture. I said I don't know. If I were
how Socratic of you. Thank you.
Yeah, but that's one of the essences of, in my mind, what it means to think critically is, one, is to formulate your beliefs on the basis of evidence, and two, is don't pretend to know things you don't know. I tend to err on the side that we can use reason not only to make better societies and improve our lives, but to make more moral societies. And I think that there are some pretty good thought experiments that people have come up with, like Rawls, for example, and Sam Harris has tried it in the moral landscape. But clearly, without any question, we're better off at trying to make societies based upon reason than we are trying to make societies based upon something else. I don't know what else, because anything else would be arbitrary, right? Anything else would be subject to some other variable. But reason is univocal. Reason is, it speaks with one voice. It's ahistorical, it's acultural. It's kind of Percian ideal inquirers.
I don't know if this is correct, and maybe you can obviously shed some light on this, but I always felt like that for us, rationality or reason itself almost seems like an impulse, perhaps not a very powerful one compared to the other impulses. Because we are a pattern-seeking species, I think that there is an intuitive part of us that seeks out pattern. I think this is why we see beauty as being something that tends to be symmetrical the same way.
Michael Shermer's done fantastic work on that, by the way, as you know, I'm sure.
It's difficult for me to just sort of say, like, let's pretend I was to make a scale of emotion, right, where I was going to say hate and anger and love or can, you know, range from 8 to 10. And where does rationality factor in all these competing impulses? Is it low or is it fairly strong, but in competition with so many other emotions that contradict reason? Or how do you think it's really sort of like, is there a strong impulse drowned out by other emotions, or is there a weak impulse, but, you know, sort of like all the other impulses themselves are usually fairly weak anyway, so you're only competing against a few?
It's a great question. Nietzsche has this idea of a will to power, a will to truth. You don't hear people talk about the will to reason. You don't hear that will and reason used very much together. I think that critical thinking and skepticism are hard work. It would be very simple. In fact, these are cultivated intellectual talents that need literally a lifetime of work. I think about this stuff constantly, and I never cease to be amazed at how frequently I'm wrong about something, or how I've misconstrued reality, or I've misconstrued a situation. So two things. One, that's why it's really important to have a willingness to reconsider, a genuine willingness to change your mind about a belief. The second thing, I don't think that rationality fits on some kind of scaffolding or some kind of hierarchical. I think that rationality is the thing that orders the scaffold and places the values on the scale. Rationality is the precondition it's the fundamental building block that enables everything, societies, language, development, and even compassion and kindness.
Would you say then that maybe the best way to describe rationality in that sense is to call it a habit?
I think it should be a habit. Strong has a great book, A Habit of Thought, when he talks about the Socratic practices, that. But I think it should be. I think that we need to habituate ourselves to certain features in our epistemic life. You know, we need to habituate ourselves to thinking, you know, how could my belief be wrong? Or, geez, have I considered this alternative? Or what's this possibility? But I wouldn't say that that's constitutive of rationality. I think that that's a manifestation, and not even of the impulses of rationality. I mean, I guess it comes back to the question of what does it mean to be a rational person? What does it mean to be, and this is a different question, but it's one that falls in the same domain, what does it mean to be reasonable? And then even a more rudimentary question, which, by the way, is answered by reason and rationality, is should I be rational? Should I be reasonable?
I like that question, but you know, the first question that you were asking, I would say that it would be difficult to answer just because so much of it seems contingent on the environment around you. Like, is a 13th century person who sells his daughter into slavery any less rational than a person today who, you know, attempts to do any of the things that seem socially acceptable?
Sell a kidney for his family.
There you go.
Okay. So you've started with difficult examples, you've started with immoral examples, and those have to be, we need to work up to those. Let me give you an example. I have a ton of keys on my key ring. I don't know where my key ring is around here somewhere, but I have a ton of keys on my key ring, and my key to my office door is the same as the key to my department door. It looks virtually identical. So I needed some way to differentiate those because it only took me a couple times, and I literally, my day is on such a razor, I don't have time to figure out which key is which. So I used reason and took one key and placed it at the top of the key ring. So now every time I go to my office, I look, I know exactly what key it is to use. I mean, that's a type of instrumental rationality. I mean, it's the use of reason to get what you want in the situation. And in this case, it's to pick the key that's going to open the door.
Well, I would say you're using more of a Roman room type of mimetic exercise, but maybe we disagree on that.
Okay, but that's, I mean, anything you want to call it, that's totally cool. But if we can agree that there are some principles like that that can either be more efficacious in terms of our time, that can be whatever principles one wants to invoke, then we can establish that there's some sort of a baseline and why reason is useful.
Okay, well, then let's go back to the second question then. Why should I be reasonable? And it seems at least partially, let's say you use your example as for now, where you're suggesting, well, how do I determine the most effective way to open these doors without every single time having to use both of these keys and trying it out and getting the frustration and blah, blah, blah. Not to take one of those horrible Buddhist stands on anything, but I could just say, well, both of those things seem relatively unimportant. The desire to try to be more proactive and efficient with time is probably even a way to just squander doing other things that could be done more enjoyably. Does it make one more happy or just merely more productive?
Two things, two responses to that. One, isn't it interesting that you use the very tool that you are criticizing? You use reason and then you use reason through words and you articulated a criticism, and people have called this a performative contradiction. It's kind of like use reason to criticize reason. I'm cool with that. I actually don't have a problem with that. But it does show you the reflective power of critical rationality and the power that language holds. Look, it gets back to what you said before about should these things that we value be our values? And my argument to you would be the only way that you could figure out what values you should have, should you sell a kidney or should you sell your daughter or what have you, the way to answer that is not through flipping a coin. It's through sitting down and weighing the options and thinking through the consequences and really taking a sincere and honest look at what it is that you're thinking about doing, and then thinking about what is the best path to get there. And if you don't use reason to that, for that, it's not clear how one could accomplish that.
Well, maybe the big problem is no one is really aware that they're using reason all the time.
Exactly. That's a
It's an automatic thing where now all of a sudden I'm saying, well, you're being reasonable in this case. Why don't you apply the same lessons of reason when looking at the things that you believe?
Yeah, it's amazing to me. I hear things all the time. You know, people have this, I just went to this excellent, Paul Russell's a Hume scholar, gave a talk Friday night at PSU, and he talked about strong skepticism, you know, like skepticism about the external world, and I just can't take that seriously. I just can't take it seriously. I hear these criticisms from people when they criticize reason and they criticize rationality, but they don't live like that, right? Like, when I make coffee in the morning, I make coffee every night, I flick on the coffee pot. I don't think that my flicking on the coffee pot is going to make me grow radishes out of my back, right? I mean, that there is some kind of causality, some regularity to the system. So I don't act. My verbal behavior of all the people who criticize reason, they don't act like that. You know, if somebody who criticizes reason, and again, there are exceptions to this, like the faith healers, but if somebody who criticizes reason breaks their leg, they don't go to the witch doctor.
Well, sometimes they do. There was a snake handler, I think, in Alabama. He got bit. He fucking believed, and now he's dead.
Right. Well, his faith wasn't strong enough.
Well, it tends to weed out the really hardcores that don't apply reason.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. There are some people who fall into this category. And I think that's the difference between misconstruing reality and being delusional. If you misconstrue reality, then you have a type of doxastic openness. You have a type of willingness to reconsider what you believe. It seems like that's an emerging theme in the podcast. But if you're delusional, you have no possibility of doing so.
You've talked about faith as being that delusion and probably, I guess, the most tragic part of it is the fact that this is a delusion that's held up as a civic virtue.
Yes, absolutely. That comes. I hope that I've made that crystal clear in all of my lectures. Yeah, it is a cognitive sickness. There's no other way to say it. It is a cognitive sickness that has inoculated itself against revision. And it is bundled, as I said in the May 6th pretending talk, it is bundled with or coupled with a moral edifice that everybody else seems to buy into. And that's why I tried to redefine faith as pretending to know things you don't know.
Well, that's not the only challenge, though. I mean, the other challenge, too, is the fact that faith has two contradicting definitions.
Well, two things. One, you're right, it's not the only challenge, but we absolutely, positively have to have terminologic change. And what are the two contradictory definitions?
Well, the first one is a belief based on no evidence, and the other one is a trust based on...
No. So you need to watch the May 6th talk, because I specifically disambiguate the difference between faith and hope. Faith is not hope, and it is not trust.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm still going on the Oxford Dictionary definition, and not just that, though. And here's the important thing, because I would rebuttal you with the fact that, because you had the same opinion, which I think you're wrong, when you didn't want to call yourself an atheist and said, I want to call myself a skeptic. And the reason why I think that's wrong is because you don't get to define words. Words get defined for you. And the definition that I've included for faith is the definition that lots of people would use. And it doesn't matter if you redefine it, because no one will just jump on that bandwagon. It's kind of like the same way that theory and theorem. You remember when they were trying to do theorem, scientific theorem?
Yeah.
It didn't work. It didn't work because there's no committee that gets to decide how words get used.
I agree with you. Wittgenstein has this idea of language games and language in context. That's why I also understand how insanely ambitious my May 6th talk was. We need to disambiguate the term faith from the term hope.
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I do.
I do. That is the ambition.
I do. It is. I know. I admit that. I completely admit it's incredibly ambitious. When people make a faith claim, look, if you want the death of religion right now, all you need is a terminologic change. All you need is one thing, is from people to stop using the word faith and start using the word hope. If you just did that one thing, religion would die. Faith and hope are not the same.
But what about the way that hope is entangled in other things too now? I mean, hope, as an irrational emotion, is things that people still need, still require.
Look, hold on a second. Hold on. This is an extremely important point. In fact, this is, you know, the Star Trek, you know, the old Star Trek. This is the red alert thing going on and on.
Sure.
Faith claims must be understood as knowledge claims. You can hope for any freaking thing you want. Anything. You can start hoping tomorrow that there's, Sam Harris uses the example, there's going to be a diamond the size of a refrigerator in your backyard. You can hope for anything you want. That's different from making it. When the faithful say that Jonas lived in the belly of a whale, and you ask them why they believe that, they say they have faith. And so then you'll say, well, is it true? Yes, it is true. Well, how do you know it's true? I have faith. That's different from hope. They're claiming to know something about the world. They're not. This is the way they use it, not the way I use it. They're not claiming, well, I hope he lives in the belly of a whale for 3 days and three nights. I hope so. No, they're claiming to know that. That's radically different. That's a knowledge claim.
Here's where I would put this ambitious project. I would put it in the same category as Dawkins' desire to change scientific theory to theorem. Except for the problem is you have less clout.
I do. I have a lot less clout, and even to be mentioned in the same sentence as Dawkins is an honor. That doesn't mean that there's something mystical that's preventing us from disambiguating the words faith and hope. And we need to call people on that. If someone tells me that they hope that, you know, when they die that they're going to go with Jesus and the Easter Bunny, whoever they're going to go, that I have no problem with that. That's fantastic. Wonderful. That's different from using the word faith as a knowledge claim. And really, this is no small point. This is, in my opinion, this is the crux of the whole problem. People are running around claiming to know things, pretending to know things that they either don't know or they can't know. They're not claiming to hope for those things. They're claiming to know them. That's different. They're claiming to know that God hates homosexuals. That's different. They're not hoping that God, well, geez, I hope that God hates homosexuals. No.
Say this ideal world where you accomplish this, does the word faith or does the word hope change? Does hope take over faith or does faith take over hope?
Great question. Then faith is only used in a religious context. You shouldn't say, you know, I have faith if I give this guy down the street $5, he's going to go and buy some milk and bring it and put it in my refrigerator. You should say, I hope. The word faith should be relegated to strictly usage in religious context. We should relegate that only to be used in a religious context. You should not use the word faith. This is every single person here can make a contribution right now. Do not use the word faith unless it's in a religious context. Use the word hope. That one thing that seems so insignificant will I think cause an avalanche.
To review, it's kind of like in the subtle way that we can change language by not using it, which I would say is subtle indeed. But, you know, nevertheless, everyone who listens now, Peter Boghossian has told you to stop using the word faith.
Unless it's strictly in a religious context. So just switch to the word hope or promise or trust. The word faith, once you understand that faith is a knowledge claim, even engaging religious people, that changes the very nature of your engagement because it gets them out of wheeze. The word faith is a slippery, tricky word. And again, I talk about this in my May 6th talk. We need to wrap a blanket around that pig. We need to take that word and nail it down and not let people when Dawkins talked to the Archbishop of Canterbury, he gave some poetic, crazy thing of depths, of whatever the hell he said. No. That's not, when you make a faith claim, you're claiming to know something. It's not hope. Hope is completely different.
It's going to be tough, though. I mean, you look, think about the very definition of faith, at least in terms of the people who are believers, right? For them, it's a knowledge claim that instantly guards itself against any objection.
Yes. And it is, as I said in the talk, it's bundled with a moral edifice. And this is Dan Dennett's belief in belief again, which keeps coming up in these podcasts. So it's this idea that you should believe that you have belief in belief, that somehow you think you're a better person for having faith or for holding this belief. And that makes it incredibly difficult to dislodge. Because then when you talk about the process of belief revision, you're talking about a moral problem and not an epistemological problem. Not a problem of how you come to knowledge, but a problem of morality, of what it says about your character and about your person.
Okay, but let me play devil's advocate for like 5 seconds.
Absolutely.
And I'm gonna go from the perspective of someone who's a belief in belief guy, right?
Okay.
And I think in this world, that belief in belief guy is surrounded by individuals who've done such a completely effective job at being able to wrap around these concepts like love, compassion, you know, the things that we would say are positive human traits, and now associated them with a God. And now for someone who has no religious affiliations, these words aren't really attached to anything. There's no reason to think that the universe is a beautiful, wonderful, love-filled place. But these individuals who were, you know, sort of like, I guess, just convinced that that's what's really happening, that's what's really going on, that the world is controlled by an entity that is all-loving and what have you, that as soon as they make, like, that the word itself, faith, will now have all these other principles attached to it that are just good. And what are we supposed to do to detach those things? Because that seems to be the first thing that's necessary. To eliminate faith as that word and make it only religious, we would need to uncouple it with all these other associations. And how the fuck are we supposed to do that?
That was a huge question. That was a huge question. I have to say, I can't remember who it was. They said, I think it was someone said to Dan Quayle or something, there you go again. So you have fallen into the very trap laid by the faithful. And here's the trap. I just tweeted about this the other day. The comment that you made, I hear so often and so frequently, to directly answer your question, we would then be talking about the consequences of people not having faith. We would be talking about all these other things. But you know what we wouldn't be talking about? The two things we should be talking about is, one is whether or not faith is a reliable guide to reality. I will not let the conversation I will not talk about anything else unless my interlocutor articulates very clearly that faith is not a reliable guide to reality. Once you say that, then we're on the same page. Then we can talk about the benefits of faith, or we can talk about the meanings of different words, or how we institutionalize these words, or, you know, I don't know, how we draw something up to put them in contemporary jurisprudence. I mean, I don't even know. But again, that's totally different than the original agenda, which is talking about, is faith a reliable guide to reality? Is the process of using for faith is an epistemology? Is it an epistemology that's more likely or less likely to get one to the truth? Even answering your question takes us further from that question.
Yeah, but the problem is because that question is never really being asked.
Which one is it?
The fact that is faith a reliable process to come to, you know, information or truth about the world? Because I'd say if tomorrow you were to ask that question in a presidential fucking debate, the answer would be yes.
Okay, well, great. Great.
From these individuals, that's what they would say. They would say yes.
Great. So, of course, because they couldn't get elected because everybody, atheists are hated more than rapists. So, yeah, that's why we need terminologic change, because people don't understand it. And, you know, you said before why, you commented why I don't use the word atheist, because people don't understand. I mean, constantly I read this stuff. People do not understand what the word atheist means. If I say to you, I'm an atheist werewolf, that means I don't believe in werewolves. It doesn't mean that if you showed me the body of a werewolf and I brought it to my buddy who's a, you know, molecular geneticist or what have you, and he put silver on and had some mystical thing of disappearing and I was shown overwhelming evidence, it doesn't mean I would still not believe in werewolves. I mean, a person who's an atheist just believes that there's not sufficient evidence to warrant belief in God.
Right. That's what it's defined as in an academic sense, right? Like, let's make the distinction here, because here's the problem. Like, the entire time what we've been talking about is the way that we should approach it academically. And I have to tell you, I'm not from the academic world. I'm from the world of, I'm the most pragmatic person you've ever met. I'm an autodidact. I learn everything on my own. And the one thing that I have learned is that it doesn't matter what you decide to define the world as. It does not conform to what you want it to be. Instead, you have to work with the world that you do, that you inherit. And in a sense, I think that we do ourselves a great disservice when we take this attitude of saying, well, the definition is wrong, and therefore I will pick to not define myself in that way and somehow improve the way that it gets defined in the future. And I'm like, that's not the way fucking shit works. If something gets defined in a particular way, you either conform to it or you fucking try to rail against it. But once there's a homogenous use of it, it doesn't fucking matter what the original intent is.
Right.
What it results in is entirely different and beyond our control. And this is why I think...
I have to stop you there. I was totally with you, everything you said, until you said beyond our control. I mean, that's what railing against it means. That's what trying to change the definitions... We can remedy these. We can remedy these. So, you know, what can you do? I really do think it is possible for people to have a movement where people don't use the word faith in any context other than a religious one. And I don't think that's unreasonable. And I think that the only people who would rail against that, to use your words, are themselves the faithful, because they understand what that would mean. One of the things that would mean is that faith would be seen for what it is, which is a knowledge claim. So I think that this is achievable. I think we can do this. I think if enough people, and it's not complicated, this is not a hard thing to do. Just don't use the word faith unless it's in a religious context.
Here's why I think it will not succeed. In the same way that I think that you would wish to redefine the term atheism, you would have no ability to do so. And I see this all the time, even in people who are agnostic, whatever, is that they do take the view that they think that the world should conform to the kind of elegant rationality that they have in their own mind. They're like, well, this is the best way to do it, and I think I can convince others to do so as well. But we face different problems. Like, the first problem is, I would just say, in terms of a numbers game, if we were to just guess, like, if tomorrow I'm like, go coin a phrase. And I mean, I use that in the literal sense of where that phrase comes from, where there was a guy who actually paid a bunch of street urchins to fucking coin a phrase, and that's why we have the word coin a phrase. But I think that we have achieved a point where, even as large as the movement might be, we may not have that kind of ability yet, where even to sort of propose it puts us in a different sort of category. Like, we're, you know, for instance, some people are like, well, people are trying to define atheism as a religion, when we already have the problem of saying that it's not well understood that this is our first fight, and if for somebody to come back and say, well, you don't even get it, I'm not even going to call myself that, means that it's one less voice in trying to actually fight back that initial misconception. So that's a big part of the problem. I think that we take this, I meant academic, not in the sense that, you know, like, you're trying to be overly learned. I'm only saying it from the perspective that you're in a bit of an ivory tower because of the nature of what you do, where it's like plenty of intelligent people that are not part of your world will reject any attempt to redefine words because that's just people's nature. They won't even fucking define themselves if they feel that there's some inconsistency in that definition because they don't want to be portrayed or painted into a corner. Well, I got to tell you, if you're not part of a force that moves something forward, then you're just part of the kind of mass that is sort of like, you know, like the mixed polarity of most elements, where the forces of magnetism are only available once everyone fucking conforms to the same polarity. You see what I'm saying?
All right. So we got two issues, right? We got two issues. The first issue is, if is it a good idea? Just forget about the second issue, which is whether or not this is it feasible? Is this achievable?
Right.
Let's stick just for now to the first issue. Do you think, because if you agree that it's a good idea to have some terminologic change for when people use the word faith, then all we need to do is to figure out how to do it. I mean, we get Sam Harris, Dawkins, we get Dennett, we get people to jump on the bandwagon. We start. I mean, there was a movement where they wanted to call atheists brights for a while.
That didn't work.
That didn't take. But it got to gain some traction.
All right, so what you need is a nice logo. Yeah.
So, I mean, my question is, do you think if you think it's a good idea, then we need to start thinking about how to do it.
Let's use another example, something I thought that was an even better idea, but that there seems to be no way to do it, where you say every scientist should use theorem rather than theory. And this should be a fairly achievable one, but scientists are still rejecting it.
But wait a second. What's the motivation for that?
Well, the motivation is to try to get rid of this whole, like, the creationists create doubt from simply its nomenclature.
Exactly. Okay. So do you think that the motivation is explicit enough to the end objective in a way that would motivate people to want to make that change?
I would say that it is that the forces to want to motivate that are as clear to some of those individuals as they are in the atheism scene. Because here's the thing. It's not to say that there are not dedicated atheists. It's
right.
To actually say that there are many who are just not.
I love that term, dedicated atheists. People who are dedicated, even that we need to unpack, right? People who are dedicated to not pretending to know things they don't know.
Yeah, but I fall into that category, Peter. Like, I know that it seems strange to people that how can you be dedicated to a non-belief in something? But when the world is actually the complete opposite of what you will have, you have to define yourself by what it is that you don't believe, as weird as that is.
And I would say to you that you are not a dedicated quote-unquote atheist, that you are really dedicated to a principle of reason and rationality. And that manifests itself in this specific domain.
I think these are just sort of definitional issues that will hurt me in the end if I tried to use your definition. It wouldn't be marketable.
Which one? The pretending to know things you don't know?
Right. If I called myself the good skeptic about the world and about religion, it would be very, it'd be a bit too lengthy. Atheist, kind of like, I can bundle that up in one word, with the word atheist, and it's pretty good.
Not pretending to know things you don't know is a virtue. I have a good buddy of mine, Matt Thornton, and one of the things that I most admire and respect about him, I've known him for over a decade, is he's a man who does not pretend to know things he does not know.
But you see, the problem is I'm arrogant, so I think I probably think I know things that I don't even know I don't know.
Yeah, okay, well then that's a meta level. That's a different kind of thinking. But it gets back to the way that we use these terms, and I would completely agree with you. In fact, 100% agree with you that this is no small challenge. That this is going to be extremely difficult to do. But if nothing else, do not let people use the word faith as a synonym for the word hope. They are not synonyms.
Well, I think I know what you need to do next then.
Go ahead, tell me, because I was going to publish a piece about it, but what do you think?
Well, there was a book I remember, it was called On Bullshit, I think.
Oh, yeah, famous.
Yeah. And I think you should do the same thing for faith. Because it was a short book. It was really short. And you know,
Was that a book? Okay.
Yeah, it is. It was an essay that eventually got turned into a short book. Because I remember he went on The Daily Show about it. And I think that in a sense, like, here's what I think. Well, I don't know if we can actually do this now because it's like putting you on the spot. But if there was like five things that a person could come out of this, you know, because you're saying, well, we should redefine it. But there should at least be five tools for a person to be equipped with to allow that to be redefined. Because just their willpower to do it is not enough. They need to be acolytes about this to some degree. They need to convince others.
Yeah, they do. Okay, well, one, we need the guys at the top to try to make this change. And then two, we need your listeners to make this change, even to bring it up in discussions. I would say that here are five things. You can put me on the spot anytime you want. The first thing is we need to recognize that faith claims are knowledge claims. I just can't say that strongly enough. Faith claims are knowledge claims. So once that's understood, it's also almost impossible to lose a debate. Once you truly understand what that means and what the implications of that are and why people fight so hard against that idea, but yet that's how they themselves use the term, everything will become clear. Okay, so the second thing you need is, and so that's more of an understanding, just simply don't use the word yourself. Just don't use it. And I said in the May 6th talk and in the Free Thought, NEPA Free Thought podcast that treat it like swearing. Put a quarter in a jar every time you use the word faith another way, and then give that money to Dawkins or Foundation.
To the good atheist. He has enough fucking money.
Oh, he's doing some great stuff, man. All those guys, Sam Harris, Shermer, all those guys, or little guys like you, you know, guys who don't have that worldwide, you know, millions and millions of people audience. Absolutely. So let's do that.
Definitely.
So
give, don't have millions.
Every time you use the word faith in non-religious context, give you 25, put a quarter, 25 cents in the jar, and give you the money at the end of the year. So that's one thing. That's one thing you can do. Here's another thing you can do besides just bringing it up in general conversation. When you do engage in these conversations, call people out on the use of the word faith. Do not let them obfuscate. Do not let them use the word faith as a synonym for hope. That is, even that alone, and of course, with the fundamentalists, that doesn't make any difference because they're the first people who these people say, absolutely, it's a knowledge claim. And again, I think that's because they're being honest. Whereas other people, the wishy-washy people in the middle, that...
The belief in belief kind of thing, guys.
Well, no, you know, the people who say, well, you know, it's all one God and different paths to the truth and, you know, people who go to church once in a while but yet profess to be a Christian... These people, as I've said before, I have genuine problems with these people because I don't think that they actually believe. Whereas the guy who handled the snake, guarantee you he believed. No question about it. I think everybody else is pretending. They're just pretending to know things that they don't know.
And that's why you're disdainful, because you're Mr. Don't Fucking Bullshit Me guy.
Yeah, just don't. I mean, look, this is not complicated. Don't pretend to know things you don't know and formulate your beliefs on the basis of evidence. And I'll add a third thing. Only use the word faith in the context of in a religious context.
All right, now we have to get to number four, though. You're skipping number four, so we got the first three. You're missing two more now because I put you on the spot. What's number four?
Number four for making this terminologic change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, distribute my last talk, pretending to know things, faith, pretending to know things you don't know, to as many people as possible. Promote it via social media. Tweet it. Get the word out so as many people as possible will see this talk.
Good. I'm writing all this down, by the way. It's going to be available in the notes and in the podcast section. These five things that you need to do to reach Peter's impossible goal. Because I will say it's not like I want to shit on your goal because I don't think it's fucking absolutely necessary. But I like to call myself as the pessimist in all things.
You're
been jaded over the years.
Look, I'm not telling you that. I'm convinced that this is going to go through, that these terminology changes are going to... I'm not telling you that.
You just hope it does.
You just stole my joke. Yeah, I hope it does. I don't have any faith that it will. I'm not making a claim to know that it will, but I hope it does.
Yeah, that's fair. See, I feel bad now because I did steal your joke, but you got to be fast with me, man.
No. You're fast and smart, so I'm...
All right, last one. Number five. We need last one.
Okay, I think it gets back to what we talked about before. Number five is broken up into several categories. One is it's really you have to model the behavior that you want to see. So if you want to initiate this terminology change, you have to not use it. Now, we talked about that before, but I think that's bundled with these other things that we talked about, and those are attitudinal dispositions. You know, those are I think it was your word, propensity to think critically, or an impulse, I think was the word you used, to think critically.
Yeah, it was impulse.
Yeah, and I think a combination of all of these things, particularly the modeling behavior in yourself, calling people out on these things, I think that if we committed to do this, we could make a change. And, you know, people talk about what would it take to make faith die? I don't know. That's a huge question. But I think that there are things that we can do to chip away at its moral edifice. I think that there are things that we can do to erode belief in belief. I think that there are things that we can do to make these silly propositions seem silly. And among these is to make sure that the words faith and hope are not used as synonyms, because they're not.
I guess in a sense, I mean, it kind of harkens back to this whole idea that we're talking about, like, because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what you're saying is true. There were studies that found that if you give people, like, critical thinking problems, part of their faith erodes, at least temporarily. So we know that just as a behavior, critical thinking is antithetical to just faith belief, because I think there should be recognized
by definition.
By definition,
it's antithetical by definition. Yeah, because the definition of critical thinking, as I defined it, is formulating your beliefs on the basis of evidence. We know that faith is not formulating your beliefs on the basis of evidence. In fact, it's even beyond not formulating your beliefs on the basis of evidence. It's pretending to know things you don't know. And if one doesn't like pretending to know things you don't know, then it's a delusion.
Well, I think that the unfortunate truth is we still live in a world in which the majority of the population, still the majority, have bought into some form of delusion, which is why, I mean, to go back to the point of why I think that the word atheist is important, not because I think that it's the true definition of the word, but only because I think that now the word has some degree of power that we can at least hold on to, and this is why I was against this whole idea of atheists who call themselves skeptics. I'm like, look, you can maybe in a world in which people fully understand that religion and skepticism are incompatible, but when there are still many skeptics who consider themselves religious, and when there are still people in the skeptical fucking community that tell me that the two are compatible, then I got to tell you, the definition of the word is not strong enough. People don't really fucking understand what it is, and the only word that actually seems to have that fucking power now is atheist. And I don't care if it's not the most accurate form of that word, but it is the word that has the most power. And this is, I guess, you know, we talk about trying to redefine words, and in a sense, it's to try to remove the power from that word. This is all the five things that you've told me, that fans should do. I'll reiterate them. Number one, faith claims or knowledge claims. You got to point that out. Number two, that you shouldn't use the word yourself, or else if you do, you should give money to the good atheist. That was a link in parentheses or highlighted. Number three, that you should challenge people on their use of the word faith. Number four, that you should distribute Peter's video, very important, and which will be in the notes and on the site itself. And number five, that you have to model the behavior that you want to see in others. I mean, we recognize that all of these things are inherently to take the power away from that word, but that word has a lot of power, and we can't deny that.
Yeah, and it's not something that's going to happen overnight.
This is a long process.
I mean, it's going to be a long process, and I think you're doing a great job and others are doing a great job to combat the faith virus. I mean, we're all making our contributions in the way that we can.
In different ways, too. I mean, like, some people were asking me, is being a big jerk about it the best strategy? And I told them, I said, that's the only strategy that I can employ because it's the only one I'm really good at.
Yeah, I don't think you're a jerk at all.
I don't think you've heard all my shows.
Well, maybe I'm not a hostile guest, too. Maybe if I were different, it'd be different if I were the guy who died from the snake bite an hour before I was bitten by a snake.
What a waste of human life, honestly. But you have the distinction of being the most excited person to come on the show, Peter.
Really? How so?
You took it the most to heart, because I mean, we had a conversation just leading up to the show, before the show, and the whole time you were sending me a message being like, I'm really looking forward to this, and you were even trying to take steps to make sure that the show was going to be good. I think you had some nervousness about me, like, well, you know, the other shows didn't seem to do well. I'm like, my shows normally do pretty good because we just, we'll shoot the shit until something interesting comes out. So I'm never really worried about it.
Yeah, it wasn't nervousness. Here's what it is. I just, maybe I take myself way too seriously. I just see what's at stake. You know, I mean, this is a huge problem. I mean, we have people running around believing books from the Bronze Age. This is an enormous problem, and I look at every time I do one of these, I look at this as an opportunity to help somebody, to make genuine cognitive change in people. But beyond that, to try to motivate people to some kind of action. Every single talk that I give, I always have that in mind. Like, how can I don't just want to, pun intended, preach to the choir. You know, I want to leave somebody with a deliverable that's actionable, that somehow that they can make a contribution to fight the faith virus. And I did listen to some of your shows, and I do think you're really good at what you do. And I want to make sure that when I do speak to you, that people are left with something meaningful, you know, something that they can use, something, some way that they can know that they can make a difference and they can make a contribution.
Well, at least they have five steps, you know, that they can do. You just gave them out. You just gave them out.
Maybe today, that was the deliverable today. You know, I didn't intend it. I had no idea. Obviously, you didn't talk about what we were going to talk about, but I had no idea about you going to ask five steps or what have you, but maybe that's a deliverable. You know, maybe that's something that someone takes from this. They recognize that faith is a knowledge claim, and they call people on it, and they don't use the word anymore, and that's great. That's a contribution.
Well, I think ultimately from everything that you have done in the past with, you know, your work with, you know, inmates and trying to get them to think critically, I think puts you in a great position to be able to tell individuals that are already pretty passionate about it but don't know what way to go about it. I think that even in those five things, including the one we're promoting your video, is going to be something like any actionable step. I'm telling you, there's lots of people out there that are willing to do stuff for the movement in general, because I think that even though maybe we will not see the consequences of our actions today, maybe we won't see them, the influence of those may be incalculable in 20 or 30 years from the people that are listening to us now, the next generation of thinkers, of doers, for fuck's sakes, listening to us and being like, I want to live in a world in which faith is redefined, in which faith is no longer, you know, has a fucking place at the discussion table where people are like, ooh, yeah, you had revelation from some creepy dude with a beard in the woods? Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, and again, that's why I think it's less productive to talk about religion and more productive to talk about faith. And even within faith, it's less productive to talk about whether or not faith is beneficial and more productive to stick on point. Stay on message, stick on point. Is faith, the use of faith, a reliable guide to reality? What does it mean to make a faith claim? How do you know that these are true? Are you willing to revise your beliefs? What would it take for you to revise your beliefs? Do you think it's important to believe things on the basis of evidence? All of these are questions are like bundled in a suite of questions that can help people when you engage someone with faith to help them lose their faith.
Well, I think the important thing to remember is the power of the Socratic method is best understood with the ultimate fate of the man himself who is put to death for corrupting the youth, which is what we're doing now.
Right, I hope that's not a metaphor for you or me. I hope there's no greater lesson for the two of us.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I will not drink the hemlock, but you know, we all know that he could have decided not to.
Right.
But would his influence in society have been as great if he just had recanted on his own beliefs?
Boy, I have no clue. I don't even know how to answer that question. I don't know.
It's a tough one because, you know, sometimes the legend is greater than the man.
Yeah, but even thinking about that response, I don't know. That was a great response, right?
That was the perfect response.
I mean, really. I hate to, I'm not, I, it's not a backhanded way to pay myself a compliment. It really is true. You asked me a question, I didn't know the answer, and I said, I don't know. And that's what we need to do. When someone asks us a question, and when someone asks your listener a question, and you don't know, say, I don't know.
I don't like that word, though. You don't make a good show by being, I don't know. I will take being wrong in certain things than basically having a long silence of, I don't know.
Yeah, it's antithetical to what someone of faith does.
Well, it's not just that. It's antithetical towards anyone who just has an entertaining show does.
Yeah, all right. Okay, I'll give you that. All right.
You know, it's got to be entertaining. Otherwise, I'm just going to get lots of letters and some writing here and be like, Jacob, your shows were highly informative, but not very entertaining.
Right. Yeah. I suppose that's the danger of saying, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly, because it's too short. It's one sentence, and you can't go really far with that. Nobody laughs at that joke. All right, well, you know what? I think that we should wrap things up. Thanks, Peter Boghossian, for coming onto the site. There's going to be links in the notes section, which is just if you're listening to this on iTunes, go to the lyrics section. You'll see all the notes, including the 5 points of things that you should do and a bunch of links that you should follow, including Peter's Twitter and a bunch of other sites where his podcasts have been hosted in the past. And check out his lecture. And as you've heard before, it's your duty to spread the word, because he's not wrong about the need to redefine faith, although I don't have as much hope as he does. Oh.
A great way to end it.
All right. With that, my name is Jacob Forte. And thank you, Peter, for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.